There we go. That means all the other blah blah I just said won't be recorded. So there are a couple of questions that came out. I'll start with those. And then again, anything you want to run with. So this one's from Katie. She always asks such great questions. Do I understand correctly that a yogi who practices generating, creating himself as a deity will let the death process arise from the non-dual clear light experience in the bardo in the same form as a deity? Okay, so let me unpack a couple of things here. What she's referring to is a big practice that we spent some time doing last weekend in the Pure Lines program, which is called Generation Stage Meditation. Huge part of Tibetan Buddhism, where it's literally what Katie's saying here. It's also called deity yoga. It's also called yidam practice. It's also called evolutionary yoga. It has a bunch of different names. But one of the things you do with this practice is you literally visualize yourself as a deity. You recite the deity's mantra. You visualize the environment as the mandala of the deity. And you might wonder, why do you do that? Well, she's on it. She's right here. There's a number of reasons you do it, but in relation to her question, as I understand it, at the moment of death, because of this practice, you will arise from the non-dual clear light experience in the bardo in the same form as the deity. Yes, before I go on with your question, Katie, that's one reason to do this practice. But here's the thing. You work with this as a way, and I think you know this, as a way to purify birth. The whole idea of generation stage meditations is literally they purify birth. And in this case, you're referring to that, but really what it refers to quite specifically is how you're purifying the shaping, the birthing of the formless dimension of your mind, not only at the end of life, arising as a deity then, but why not arise as a deity now, right? So what you say is absolutely run on. You do this practice so that when you dissolve into the non-dual formless clear light experience, and this, by the way, when you're doing full-blown generation stage practice, you know this when you recite the mantra Om Sva Bhava Shuddha Sarva Dharma Sva Bhava Shuddha Aham. That is basically designed to intimate the clear light mind in the daily practice. And then, yes, you arise as the deity in preparation for death, but just as importantly, you're purifying rebirth of your mind now, moment to moment to moment, so that then instead of arising as a reified Joe Schmo or Josephina Schmo, you arise now, moment to moment, as a deity, which means you take on the form of compassion, which is Chenrezig. You take on the form of wisdom, which is Manjushri. You take on the form of power, which is Vajrapani. So this is a multivalent practice that for sure does apply to the big arising at the end of life, but just as much so, it works with purifying birth moment to moment right now. Okay. Oh, and the other thing that can happen here, yes. So if you have real proficiency with this, fundamentally, someone who has this kind of control over their mind, not only can they arise as a deity and then go immediately into that deity's pure land, they can arise as anything, literally. Literally, they can arise, and this is really pretty out there kind of stuff. They can arise as what we would call inanimate appearances. They can arise as a breeze or as a medicine or as a bridge or as a tree. It's like, what are you talking about? That's what tradition says, that when you really understand the nature of reality is the nature of mind itself, by forming your mind that way, you can actually form what we would call physical inanimate objects. So this type of proficiency not only extends to arising as a deity, voluntary nirmanakaya, voluntary tohu, you know that term. You can arise as anything. Out there stuff, but that's what they say. Further, her question, the mind contracts voluntarily to an illusory body of the deity. Yeah, you could say you could say contracts voluntarily, yes, versus involuntary rebirth, impure rebirth into an illusory body of the deity. Yes, it condenses, it crystallizes, it emanates in the form of a deity. And remember, what does deity represent, right? It's not like some cartoon character. The deity fundamentally represents purity. So you're rising as a pure illusory form by doing this. So it's a slightly esoteric question, but so be it. The mind contracts voluntarily to an illusory body of the deity to prevent impulsive contraction to the samsaric body. Absolutely, high five, spot on. You got it. second part of the question, or question two, does mind always have some form, body, bodies? Yes, it does. And that's why the word kaya is used, K-A-Y-A, in the Buddhist, the roughest, grossest three body manifestation thing. You got, as you know, nirmanakaya, fully formed body, sambhogakaya, subtle body, dharmakaya, very subtle, formless body. So there's a reason why kaya, the word kaya, is used. Mind is always embodied, even if that body is very, very subtle. And so at the really, really subtle dimensions, it's no longer a physical body. It's literally a body made of prana mind. So there's no such thing as a non-embodied mind. It just doesn't make any sense. And this is one of the great books that was written in kind of launched the cognitive science movement, literally The Embodied Mind, Francesca Varela, Evan Thompson, Eleanor Roche. This was a really landmark book, I don't know, 25, 30 years ago, where Francesco and company talk about all mind is embodied. It's just subtle, gross, or very, very subtle. Okay, good questions, Katie. Okay, from Stephen. Well, this may not be a typical nightclub question. That's okay, because this is not a necessarily a nightclub forum. I wondered if you might answer a question on the recent sessions on the Pure Land. So it looks like Stephen here attended the Pure Lands, which is awesome. Pure Lands, Hidden Lands, Sacred Lands. On the Tanka behind me, yeah, so during that weekend, I had a Tanka of a religious scroll of Sukhavati, the Pure Land, and Amitabha, the Buddha of that Pure Land. On the Tanka behind you was Vajrapani, yes, correct? The Bodhisattva power, both in wrathful and peaceful emanations. Could you please explain why there are peaceful and wrathful emanations? Yeah. Well, because there are many ways that the mind can manifest. And really, the archetype here is the what are called the Shitro, S-H-I-T-R-O, peaceful, wrathful deities in the Bardo, in the luminous Bardo of Dharmata, where Stephen, as you may or may not know, there's 100 of these peaceful, wrathful deities that arise. And they're basically archetypal representations of the spectrum of the manifestation of mind. And sometimes it's peaceful, and sometimes that manifestation can be wrathful. Tough love. There's a place for this type of manifestation. And interestingly enough, the math is interesting, because if you do, I think there's 52 wrathful deities, 48 peaceful deities. So there are actually more wrathful emanations than there are peaceful emanations. So basically, why is that? It's because the mind manifests in this multitudinous kind of display. It can manifest in peaceful. There's also called the Vijadara emanations, the semi-wrathful emanations, and then there are the wrathful emanations. And basically, again, it just points to the fact that the mind can radiate, shine, manifest in all these different ways, which are represented then in these deities, the iconography of these particular deities. Okay, Stephen? Last one. What are the best books you can recommend to give an accurate description of the 64 relative cities? I don't have any, because I'm not interested in relative cities. So let me tell you why I'm not that interested in these sorts of things, because city, S-I-D-D-H-I, the 64 relative cities, there's a difference between relative and absolute city. And the relative cities are all the things like clairvoyance and telepathy and clairaudience and all these kind of psychic abilities, which are great. I guess they're kind of cool. But they're not really touted, especially in the Tibetan arena, at all. Very little. Because you can slide into the sorcerer's trap. And so the relative cities can be helpful if they're used to benefit others. But they are not touted in the traditions that I study, because they can be sidetracks. The sorcerer's trap can be a real shadow element to this type of power. So the much, much more important power is absolute city. And then my languaging here is, this is the way I relate to it, absolute city. Well, relative city is when you have power over the world. That's when you can do all these shape-shifting things and all these capacities of manipulating the environment, the miracles. Christ could do it, all the great masters could do it, because basically they become so open, they mix their mind with the kind of mind at large, the mental nature of reality, And therefore, they can actually influence it, shapeshift it in these kind of miraculous ways, hence the relative cities. So that's interesting, but potential trap. What's much more important is absolute city is when the world no longer has power over you. That's real power. So I can't really recommend books here because I'm not interested in this stuff. I find this stuff actually, no criticism, it's just me. I find it distracting. Do you believe in people who are able to communicate with animals telepathically? Yeah, why not? Lots of people, not just meditators, but empath psychics on the one have this capacity. And I saw this really cool video. I can't remember. I mean, I've seen so many of these over the years. I can't remember what it was called, but it was out there. This guy with a big top knot, some siddha, some master, was actually able to summon birds. It was just, and they'd show him. He'd be sitting there and he was doing some whistling thing. I can't remember. And he'd hold his little finger out and these birds would just come like flying around and they'd all come landing on his hand. Like, right. The only time that happens to me is when I go skiing in Steamboat and I go up this chairlift and I put all this bird food in my hand. Then the birds come and land on my hand. But I thought that was actually pretty cool. You know, here he is. He's just holding his finger out there and he's just, you know, doing this whistling thing, I think. And these birds are flying around and they come down and he's like landing on his hand. So, I mean, why not? You know, I mean, who's to, you know, when the mind opens again, this is where all these powers come from. The fact that we don't have these kinds of powers is because we're so contracted. We shut ourselves off. But all these types of powers, telepathy, telekinesis. I mean, when I was studying the New Age stuff decades ago, I did think this stuff was kind of cool. These are natural consequences of porosity, of being so open. And so do people have this ability? Absolutely. Is this one of the 64 relative cities? I have no idea. King Solomon and St. Francis were both rumored to have this skill. Hey, why not? Anybody can do it. You can do it. Would really love to know if the Buddha possessed this ability. No doubt he did, but I'm sure he just wasn't that interested in propagating these sorts of things because then people go, oh, I think I'm going to study Buddhism so I can get birds to land on my finger or whatever. You know, you get the whole thing. Like, I'm just going to develop these powers so I can read minds and all that. Boy, oh boy, that is the wrong motivation. And that's why I don't really riff on the stuff at all, because that totally can distort your intention. Your intention is to open your mind and heart, achieve wisdom and compassion for the benefit of others. If relative cities and powers come from that, that's great. But don't use them for yourself. Use them for others. So don't distract. Again, me, just me. Don't distract yourself with this kind of stuff. Just me. Yeah. And the rest of it is about my dog. Yes, my dog. You mentioned, my dog was able to discriminate mental states. That's not, my dog isn't. I think my dog actually is a bodhisattva. I have no doubt. He's here to teach me. But those of you who have pets, you know this. Your pets are psychic. I mean, they have these incredible extrasensory capacities, right? My dog is not alone in doing that. I just feel really sorry for him because if he can read my mind, he must be leading a very tortured dog life. So anyway, questions or comments, those are all the ones that came in, I think. I will check further, but if there's anybody here who has a question or comment, I'll check the chat column. We're okay, and then so, and if there's another question, again, anybody who sent in one of these questions that may want to follow up on any of those, more than welcome to come on. But that's kind of what comes to mind. Okay, from Lynn, I recently heard a talk about somatic meditation. Yeah, I'm just gonna run the comments as we go through this, Lynn, because it's a long riff here. I'm a huge fan of somatic meditation because if your meditation does not include your body, it's incomplete. Could very well be Reggie's stuff because he's huge on that and I really like his work. The speaker mentioned that there are recent scientific studies or at least one study that shows that when someone is experiencing outrage, specifically the quality of outrage, not just simple anger, that it lights up the pleasure centers in the brain. Okay. In your readings and study, have you come across this information? I have not. But do you know how many studies are out there? I mean, even in the world, let's just leave it at this, Lynn, even in the world of meditation, I used to try to keep up with these. I got a monthly thing. I think I discontinued it a couple of years ago because it was just overwhelming. Every month I got a readout of all the studies that were coming out in the world of meditation. There's over 1,000 a year. That's well over three. That's three over three a day, right? There's no way I can keep up with this stuff. So I wait till the ones, just like everybody else, I kind of scan across. I wait for the things because there's a lot of bad studies out there. Richie Davidson and Dan Goleman in their book, Altered Traits, talk about, this book was published 3 or 4 years ago. And at that point, there were something like 7,000 studies on meditation. And then they go through just weeding out, just saying a lot of these are just like bad study model, bad everything. So, you know, just because something is so-called scientific study, I'm always really, really careful of these. Is it replicated? I mean, is it peer-reviewed? Is it double-blind, placebo-controlled? Just because something is in print, maybe you've noticed this, doesn't necessarily mean it's true, but I have not come across that. If true, this could go a long way to explain so many people seemingly being addicted to outrage these days. Well, I can't speak to that study, but people are addicted to everything because we live in the realm of addiction. No kidding. We talked about this in the Pure Land program. The three cosmological realms in Buddhist cosmology, the realm of form, the formless realms, and the realm of desire. We as human beings live in the realm of desire, which is fundamentally a euphemism. It's a realm of addiction. We're fundamentally addicted to all kinds of things. I'm a thought junkie, right? I'm addicted to my thoughts. It's a form of substance abuse. So we're addicted to all kinds of things. I'm addicted to this body. I'm addicted to form. I'm addicted to whatever, discursiveness and all the sillinesses that still occupy my being. But I think one of the biggest reasons that people are addicted to outrage, Lynn, with or without this study, is that when you think about particular emotions, I can't think of anything that's more solidifying than anger, outrage, fear. I think that's one reason people are addicted to these emotions. And that's why they're marketable. That's why they're campaignable, because no emotion makes me more solid than things like outrage, anger, fear. And so I think people are addicted to those because they're reifying emotions. They're reconstituting emotions. And you may notice this when things fall apart. It's very easy to notice this, especially in the death and dying business, for people to get really pissed off. And I conjecture that that's because when things are falling apart, sometimes the only way you can get it together is to get pissed off. And so, yeah, I mean, this is a really interesting set of topics, you know, like the addiction principle altogether, detoxification from that. But what I take away with this, what I want to just share from my own experience is just look at how solidifying something like outrage is. And that's why people are addicted to it, because ego is the archetype of reification. Outrage is a highly reifying emotion. I think that's why we're addicted to it. I can't speak about this pleasure center releasing. I just don't know. My favorite answer, I just don't know. Quick question from Francesca in Menlo's newsletter. They announced the New Year's retreat and you are part of the program. Am I? Well, that's good to know. This is actually quite humorous. This happens a lot these days. In fact, Alyssa was just telling me something popped up on social media that I'm doing a presentation next Thursday. It's not in my calendar. Maybe it's one of my emanations. Maybe it's from Katie's question, my capacity to generate and emanate another deity or whatever will do that presentation. Well, I don't know about this, Francesca. I have been invited to participate in that last couple of years, and I'd be honored and delighted to do it again this year, because Bob Thurman and the wonderful usual suspects there are just the best people. And so it's definitely not in person. It's going to be online, at least for me. If there's... I'm definitely not coming back for that. So I apologize. I really don't know about this one. Thank you for bringing it to my attention. I'll have to reach out to them. Okay. From Lynn, I often have a hard time telling if I'm dreaming or lucid dreaming or in the hypnopompic state. Do you have any guidance to help me tell which I'm in? Yes, I do. Does it matter if I know which state I'm in? Well, it does matter in the sense, Len, that it can bring a level of articulation and clarity to the manifestation of your mind. And whether you append the label, liminal dreaming, lucid dreaming, hypnagogic, hypnopompic, or whatever, that's up to you. But it does matter in the sense that it bespeaks the fact that you're actually lucid in that state. Now, whether you wake up and say, you know, am I in any one of these multi-dimensional manifestations of mine? That on a fundamental level is not, I guess, exceedingly important, but the fact that you can actually identify what type of bandwidth of consciousness you're inhabiting, I think that's helpful. So in that sense, I think it does matter. So I have a hard time telling if I'm dreaming or lucid dreaming. Okay, well, first of all, there is a definitely the difference between dreaming and lucid dreaming, right, Lynn? So what I'm suspecting you're experiencing is a degree of lucidity in the normal dream state. Otherwise, you wouldn't be asking this question. And so let's just take two really overt examples. So on the best case scenario, you know, classic non-lucid dream is just that. The vast majority of dreams for people, you're dreaming, you don't know that you're dreaming. You're basically, you take everything that takes place in the experience to be real. Lucid dreaming is just the complete converse of that, right? You're actually aware now that you're dreaming, but lucidity comes in degrees. And so if you have a hard time telling whether you're dreaming or a lucid dream, my guess is you're probably in a liminal space like you're talking about here when you talk about the hypnopompic space. In other words, there's a degree of lucidity, right? And so therefore, my guess, based on what you're sharing here, is if you're having a hard time telling, you probably are in that hypnopompic space, that liminal space, which is the post-sleep state. Hypnagogic is the state where you're not awake, you're not in a dream going in. Hypnopompic, you're not awake, you're not dreaming or sleep going out. So based on what I'm hearing here, Lynn, it sounds like just by the nature of the question that you probably are in that kind of liminal space. And so, you know, if you can gain a little bit more familiarity, a subtle nuance, understanding of your mind through meditation altogether, then what happens is you develop this witnessing capacity. You're more able to articulate the dimension of consciousness that you're actually inhabiting. Okay, so I'm not sure I'm entirely hitting your sweet spot there, Lynn. And if you want to come on and say something about that, I'm happy to run with it further. But that's what comes to mind. Okay, from Tim, basically the cities are what we can do in lucid dreams. Well, that's a different story. That's not one of the 64 cities, though. But those realized master can do them in waking life. So we just have to move on to the higher level of mind. Is that correct in your opinion? Yes, I would say that's a more elevated way to look at all these things. Correct. That you can use these powers as they're developed in the dream state. And this is, in fact, one way. So it's interesting, like, where do these powers come from? So, Tim, they come from a number of capacities. One is, in fact, a capacity to be extraordinarily proficient with lucid dreaming and its daytime practice of illusory form. That's one way to develop these cities. Another way is through, believe it or not, through shamatha, through basic standard mindfulness. When your mindfulness practice becomes extremely capable and extremely strong, these capacities of relative city also are a natural consequence of that. And this is where they can become a trap for meditators. They can drop into these spaces, they develop these kind of relative powers, they get stuck there. And that's why these things, you know, opportunity can transform into obstacle if you don't have a proper understanding. The other way cities come from, the third way, and they're more, the other way they come about is obviously through ultimate awakening. When you attain the awakening of any kind of Buddha, any master, then at that point, you're actually able to shape-shift reality because you see it as fundamentally no separate from your own mind. So what you're saying is fundamentally great. Just move that, what you're talking about, to a higher level and work with relative city in application to absolute city. Okay, so Keenan, hey buddy, fire away.
Hi, Andrew.
Hey man, nice to see you.
Yeah, good to see you. I had a quick question since we were talking about deity yoga. I've recently, this is something new in my path, and I'm looking at studying more from the Kashmir Shaiva standpoint.
Okay.
And in this tradition, the way, at least from my understanding, the practices are given is that the deities are within you. It almost seems like that an individual is considered like almost a hologram of the universe, and the deities are sort of invoked from within. So I'm doing the sadhana, and I just wanted to check with you if you had any pointers, or in your own journey, does that land with you in the Tibetan tradition?
It does land with me. And you know, you can relate to the deity principle in a number of ways. So this is the difference between front visualization and self-visualization. So when you're doing deity yoga and you're invoking a front visualization, then you're invoking the provisional externality of that deity principle. So whatever, I don't know what deity you're doing, but let's say like this weekend we did Amitabha. You visualize Amitabha in front of you. You do all the things that are associated with that. That's a way to invoke that Amitabha principle in a provisional external way. A little bit more, so that's stage, in a certain sense, stage one. Stage two would be the self-visualization, which is what you're talking about. You actually arise as the deity. And then what that does is exactly what you're saying. It evokes, invokes that particular deity principle within you. Let's say in this case, the Amitabha within you to come out. And then fundamentally, the really, in a certain sense, the fruition is the dissolution of interior and exterior, where you basically come into a non-dual understanding of both the inner and the outer. But I think with the type of practice that you're doing, the internality, the fact that all these deities are within you, that's really the most important thing. And that also ties into the earlier question when I was talking about in relation to Katie's question. When we're talking about the 100 peaceful and wrathful deities that manifest at the moment of death, well, why do they manifest at the moment of death? Because they're part of the emergent unconscious mind. And so what happens when you die? Your unconsciousness is revealed. And that's not always a bad deal. It's only a bad deal if what you've stuffed into the unconscious is full of crap, right? Then that creates some of the perilous aspects, the harrowing aspects of the Bardo Dharma Ta. But where the 100 peaceful, wrathful deities come from in the purest expression of the Dharma Ta, the luminous Bardo of Dharma Ta, they're shining in that dimension because basically that level of purified being within you, that's now expressing itself in this archetypal form, see? And so in a real way, when you're engaging in this self-visualization and invoking the deities within you, you're bringing those unconscious processes into the light of consciousness. And then, so a couple of things happen. When you die, there won't be any surprises because that'll manifest now in living color, just like in a dream where mind becomes reality. Because right now, you may visualize yourself as Amitabha or whatever, but you still look at your hand, you still look in a mirror until you get really advanced in this practice and you realize you're just faking it. You know, I don't see myself that way. So in a certain way, you're superimposing a template experience that's actually in resonance with reality. But eventually you do that long enough that, hey, one day you may look down at your body and see that it's not looking the same way before. You look in the mirror and you might see something different. But the whole idea here is that you're trying to bring some of these unconscious processes, you're trying to invoke them, bring them into the light of consciousness so that they transform you now and also at the moment of death. So that's what comes to mind, and I'm happy to run with this further with you if you have something else to say or ask. But deity yoga, you could tell me, I mean, how do the Kashmiris, what do they say? How do they relate to it?
My understanding is sort of limited, but in terms of the practice, the way you're describing is I'm just doing some practices with the goddess Kali, and they have like the 12 Kalis in the Kashmir Shaivism, which is kind of the unfolding of space and time. It seems like. And so I'm just relying on the mantras and the longing. And I guess that was my question, is if one is just left with a deep sense of longing and just the mantras, would those suffice? Because I know when you get into it, some of the practices can be very elaborate and you have to receive them from the proper channel, I suppose.
That's a great question. Yes, it can suffice. In fact, the devotion alone can suffice. You don't even have to do the mantra. So devotion is the most important thing, especially in any level of Tantra, that's the most important thing. Because why? What does it do? Devotion opens your heart. It just opens. if you conjoin devotion with mantra recitation, that you're ramping it up even more, because now you're actually involved with the acoustic manifestation of that deity. And as Chris Wallace, you know, as you know, he's a pretty savvy Kashmir Shaivist guy. He basically says the mantra is the deity in sonic form. And so when you're reciting the mantra and involved with devotional aspects, that's really fantastic. If you want to take it just another step further, then you add the visualization thing. So that's another way to even ramp it up, right? And then what this does, when you add the mantra and you add the visualization, in addition to the supercharging of the devotion, what that does is it's basically working with the sound and light nature of both a deity and a reality, right? Because reality fundamentally is of the nature of sound and light. And then when you get down to the very essence of reality, remember, what do they say in the Christian traditions? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was made flesh. Everything is fundamentally reducible to sound, mantra. And mantra is the purest form of sound next to silence. And then light. And the purest form of light is the light of the mind that's worked with in the visualization thing. So if you're doing devotional practices with mantra, that's bloody fantastic. But if it does light you up, so to speak, or inspire you, you can ramp it up even a little bit further by bringing in the visualization end, because not only will that help to invoke the presence of the deity, but it also works to stabilize the mind. You know, I mean, when you're working with a visualization, literally the kind of artistic end of it, completely trying to just make it as clean and precise as you can. That's a form of tantric shamatha. That's a way of stabilizing your mind. So these are all incredibly skillful means that you can use depending on what, in this case, almost literally resonates with you. But just to repeat, if you're doing the devotion thing, that's number one. You can augment that, supplement that with mantra and visualization. That just adds some rocket fuel to what you're already doing.
Thank you. And maybe just out of curiosity, a last thing I would ask is, when you were talking about earlier the archetypes, are these deities, you would say, have been created by certain masters, or are they pre-existing?
They're pre-existing. Yeah, they're like Platonic. They're like Platonic archetypes, right? They're not Jungian archetypes. They're Platonic archetypes. So they're part of the involutionary trajectory, right? And so one of the things you're doing, I'm not sure I want to go that far. But yeah, they're exactly that. They're not made up. The masters don't make them up. It's like with mantras. The masters aren't making up the mantras. They're just incredibly sensitive listeners that my languaging hack into the vibratory code of reality. They're not making them up. They're hearing them. And so the deities, those are inherent as well. What they do, so to speak, make up or color, like a coloring book, is the particular cultural iconographical representation of that deity principle. See? And so therefore, maybe the Bodhisattva Chenrezig in, and again, I'm just shooting from the hip, in the Buddhist tradition would be analogous to Mother Mary or even Jesus, right? You know, there it's just that particular principle is just evoking itself in a different dressing, so to speak. So they don't make them up in that fundamental sense. They discover them, they share them. What they do make up or color are the particular iconographical representations. See, and that's why we always have to be careful when we do these things to realize this is why the three aspects of visualization. One is what's called the purity principle, where you understand basically what every aspect of the deity represents, so that you don't get hung up on the anthropomorphizing of that deity. See what I'm saying? So they don't make them up. They discover them. They color them in the particular cultural environment that they're embedded in. And this is also helpful to know when people die. Will everybody experience these deities in the same way? Absolutely not. You know, why on earth would a Christian experience a Buddhist deity? Why would a Muslim experience a Christian deity, right? That just ain't going to happen. So that's why you have to separate out the relative from the absolute, that these are very powerful heuristics, teaching tools, but eventually at a certain point, you realize both their strengths and their limitations. And like with relative city, you just let all that go. Okay.
Andrew, would you have any pointers on how to receive a visualization? Because there are visualizations in the public sphere, but I'm assuming that you have to somehow have a...
Well, you don't have to, but yes, there are different types. There are different ways to do these practices. What we're talking about here, you know, is a little bit of a blend between the over-the-counter public sutra level teachings, like the Manjushri, Tara, Avalokiteshvara, and Vajrapani to a certain extent. These are all sutra level. You don't have to have a whole lot of transmissions or empowerments to do these. But, you know, to really do full-blown tantric practice, that's a slightly different story. Then you go and you get the Abhishekas, the Wongs, the empowerments, and you do, for instance, like either a four-day, again, there's so many of them, a Kala Chakra empowerment or something. And then when you do that, then that's a whole different league. You're entering a whole different league of practice. There you get the magic of the whole tantric thing. And so it's a little bit like you've gone from 110 to 220. You know, the current is just a lot stronger. But that also requires a tremendous commitment. You can't go in there in a dilettantish way. You're not dating anymore. You're getting married, and so there's a commitment level that's involved here. So that's not in any way to dismiss the sutra level practices. They're fantastic. They all have a place. But as you know, there's a difference between just speed dating and getting committed to something, someone. When you really commit and you do the empowerments and you kind of join in, then there's you know, it's part of the taking the refuge thing. You know, you're taking refuge at a provisional level in Buddha Dharma Sangha. At the Vajrayana level, you're taking refuge in the protector, the Yidam, and the guru. And so at that level of refuge bestows a higher level of so-called benefit. But that depends on the person's predispositions, how committed they are, how resonant they are with it. It's not in any way to criticize any of these other approaches. It's just that there are prescription strength mantras. There are prescription strength visualizations. There are prescription strength deities. Mixing metaphors, in order to do those, you have to go see your doctor and get that prescription, right? That's strong medicine. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Very welcome. Okay. Let's see. Did anything else trickle in here? Are we good for today? Stephanie. Hey, Stephanie. Nice to see you.
Good to see you too. I came in a little bit late and I just caught the tail end of your you're talking about cities and stuff. And I just wanted to share something just because I thought you'd enjoy it, or some of the people here might enjoy it. An experience I had with my teacher. So I have a Qigong teacher who, he's the person who, he's a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner, long time, who he's the person who kind of nudged me into practicing mantras and kind of which led me to, you know, and until I met you and have learned a whole lot more through this, because he didn't go into a lot of the conceptual stuff. But anyway, so in the context of Qigong, there are a variety of kind of internal milestones that happen, and probably 15 years ago this happened or something, where I experienced something and I recognized it. Again, he didn't describe a lot, but just enough that I would know that something I would call attention to it. But anyway, I experienced something that I thought, oh, that this is that. And I remember going in to see him and to practice or whatever. And I walk in and I'm all kind of excited to tell him, like, you know, this thing happened, and is this that or whatever. Before I could open my mouth, you know, I was there barely 5 minutes, and he just goes, oh, this thing happened to you. He fully just told me exactly what had happened to me. Right. And this is an internal energetic thing. There is no external means of recognizing this thing. And it blew me away. I just said, I was just going to tell you that. How did you know? How did you know? And he just, without missing a beat, says, your body is my body.
Yeah.
And it was just like no big deal to him, and totally like just another phenomenon that he recognized without even trying. That struck me obviously at the time. And I'm learning more about a lot of this now through all of this with you. And you know, but it was notable. Just
that's
his response.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. And that's really indicative of a real teacher, you know, and because it, these cities are part and parcel for people that are that open and awake to that degree. That's just the way they roll. But they don't tout it. They don't market it. They never brag about it. They never even talk about it. But like you, I've had a number of experiences like that where, I mean, 1,000% the teachers like read my mind. 1,000% he's completely tuning in. And let me share another story. This is somewhat connected to the earlier thing where I remember early on, I went to see what my teacher, and you know, I was actually really excited. You know, I had this kind of breakthrough thing, and I was all excited, you know, to like, in a certain sense, it's a little, my neurotic interjection, you know, to be recognized as like, you know, some unrecognized tuku or some bullshit thing, right? And so here I am sharing my story to my teacher, and I am not kidding. He like looks out the window and just like yawns, right? He could care less. And that in itself was like the most important teaching, because I came in there like, oh, you know, he's gonna acknowledge me. He's gonna, I mean, he just literally looked out the window, yawned and changed the topic. And that in itself is, it's not what I wanted, but it was what I needed, right? And so when I hear stories like yours, those are so awesome. And they're indicative of real teachers who have these powers, but they never talk about them. They never, unless it's a benefit to others. And on a one-on-one situation like you, sometimes you'll share these sorts of things.
Yeah.
But in my opinion, anybody who does that in a public kind of setting, for me, that's a real marker that they're not a real teacher. They're a sorcerer to some extent. And I get a little weary about that kind of thing.
I got to tell you, full disclosure, that yawning response, I've got that a lot from this guy too, yeah, over the years. Yeah. You know, like, yeah. I'm all excited. And he's just kind of like no interest.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly. So it's like that, this famous story, you've heard me share this from Gampopo coming to see Milarepa. It's such a great story. You read the biography of Milarepa. I can't remember, maybe it's Gampopa's biography, but it doesn't matter. Where Gampopa, you know, comes to see Milarepa, and one day he's in like really long retreat, and he goes, Milarepa, oh my gosh, this last week, I saw the mandala of Chakrasambhara and the sky was bursting with deities. And he went on and on, and just about how ecstatic and fantastic everything was. And Milarepa simply said, it's neither good nor bad, continue. Month later, Gampopa comes back. He goes, oh, this last month has been total crap. I've never been in so much. I want to commit, you know, I'm going to commit suicide. I'm so depressed. I'm a loser. I can't do anything. What does he say? It's neither good nor bad, continue.
Yeah.
That's the point. And the thing what happens with these relative cities is you think now you're something. You think there's some achievement thing, and that's it. You just killed your progress. You're dead in the water. So you just have to let all this stuff go. And that's the problem with these relative cities, is because they're for real. They absolutely positively exist, but you don't talk about them really. You don't really share them unless in really intimate settings where it can be a benefit to others. Because these can become really dangerous traps. You think you're getting onto something, you think you're getting some kind of power, and that's when everything just comes to a screeching halt. So, yeah, thanks for sharing that, Steph. That's awesome. Yeah, sure. Love it. Okay, yeah. Dr. Jerry.
Uh-oh, Jerry, you're not unmuted yet. There you go.
Hi, Andrew, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can now. Hey, bud.
Well, anyways, you know, you have talked frequently, very frequently, about, you know, false meditation teachers or ones that really, you know, you shouldn't be going to see. And, you know, I said before, I know no one in my circle who practices meditation, you know, reads like, you know, the Eastern or Western literature about spirituality or whatever you like to say. Even people who claim to be Christians don't read the Bible. But anyways, about 20 years ago or 30 years ago, I was living in Portland, Oregon, and I read the book by Paramahamsa Yogananda.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I was very impressed, very impressed. And they had a local chapter of the Self-Realization Fellowship there. So, you know, I went and, you know, I became like a lay member. You know, I'd go to their meditation sessions, their Sunday sessions, you know, and but, you know, I was moving out of Oregon, and even though, you know, like I had some interesting experiences, I never really could connect with anyone in the group. I mean, it wasn't they were impolite or they ignored me, but I never had a feeling of connection. Well, anyways, when I left Oregon, of course, you know, I left that group. And then years later, like maybe just within the last year or two, I was reading literature about, you know, various masters, and I ran across several articles that said Paramahamsa Yogananda, his public image was one of, you know, like this pure master who was out to help everyone. And he was traveling the world to set up all these, you know, things to bring spirituality into the world. That in fact, he had a violent temper, and that he actually had sexual relations with his, a lot of his ashrams consisted of young girls.
What a surprise.
And that one reporter read into one of the children, this is after Paramahamsa died, one of his children who admitted, yeah, he was the son of one of these encounters. And so the question is, I mean, I really admired the guy, you know, and I was trying to practice. How in the world, I mean, do you find you have a good meditation teacher?
How do you know if you have a good meditation teacher?
Yeah, I mean, one who isn't like, you know, has a public image, but a private image that is.
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I mean, there are some metrics. And I mean, this is a big topic. It's an important one. I riff on this a lot these days. This is yet another of the infinite instances of the importance of an integral approach to psycho-spiritual development. That it's not just along the vector of waking up, it's also on the vector of growing up. You've heard me riff on this, Jerry.
Oh, yeah.
You have to have, at least in my opinion, there has to be this integral approach to your awakening, because otherwise you can have a high state level realization like him or like so many others. We all know their names, which is, it's authentic. It's an authentic glimpse of a high level state, but then what do you do with it? You download it the minute you open your mouth, you download it through a particular structural level of development. And that's where the crapshow starts. So that's why these things take place. And that's why they're going to continue to take place, because there's this kind of blindness and this kind of supremacy that the somehow state level realizations can basically trump everything. They can't. And that's why the stuff will continue. So how do you find an authentic teacher? Well, I mean, you got to be extremely careful. You have to ask the tough questions. You have to trust your intuition. You have to look at, do they practice what they preach? In other words, how much do they devote their lives in selfless service to the others? How compassionate are they? What type of philanthropic organizations do they have? How humble are they? Do they fly below the radar? And what are their senior, what is their community like? And what are their senior students / again, kind of second tier teachers like? And so if you go through that and you start making the checklist, you will find that there are communities. I can give you names of people that I have worked with, studied with, that I have, like, at least at this point, I would be really shocked if something came out that I have close to 100% confidence in. But the bottom line is, in this day and age, you have to be extremely careful, right? Because you can get seriously, you know, almost irreparably damaged when you open the way real spiritual practice is designed to open you. And then you get violated and abused in this way. To me, that's the worst type of abuse. So those are just the criteria I use. How humble are they? How, you know, look at Trungpa Rinpoche, for instance, right? Again, he's one, I mean, he's devoted his life to helping others. I mean, he's got a whole array of monasteries and schools and I mean, everything. No interest in the limelight whatsoever. Check out, again, students. What are they like? Are they willing to listen to tough questions? Are they willing to be criticized? Are they willing to really look at themselves in that way? So I think there are criteria. Jerry, and the other ones that I recommend without hesitation, Sagnya Rinpoche, his organization, Pundarika, Teregar, Mingyur Rinpoche, he's an unbelievable teacher, no hesitation whatsoever, Punlop Rinpoche, Nalanda Bodhi, Dzangsar Khyentse Rinpoche, Khandro Rinpoche. I mean, I know these people, I've been around them. I haven't seen anything resembling shadows anywhere in these communities. So that's what comes to mind, my friend. I don't know if that's very helpful. But
how do I find one in my area here in southeastern Michigan? I've looked and looked and looked. And
well, it doesn't always have to be, you know, you might not find one in did you say eastern, southeastern Michigan?
Southeastern Michigan, yeah.
Yeah, but you don't have to have one in your hood these days, you know?
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Even when I was studying with my teacher, Kempo Rinpoche, he said, he told us frequently, he said, you know, you don't need to see your teacher, but maybe once a year.
Really?
And then there's, yeah, exactly. It's not like you need to be around them all the time. So you go, you know, these people very often, they'll come by, they'll do an annual kind of tour. You go in, you connect with them in person. Now that COVID is over, you can do stuff with them online, that sort of thing. You do not need to have consistent contact with these. In fact, sometimes that can actually water down your thing because you get into this kind of God-addicted space where you just want to hang out in a kind of darshan mode, where you're just kind of soaking in their environment. I personally have found it very, very helpful to just have a deep connection to a teacher you trust, see them once a year, and then when you or even less, and then when you see them, you're going to be really primed. You're going to really do the work that they set you out to do. And then during the interim period, you gather the rain of blessings that they give you. You go off, you do your work, you come back, and you see them again. You don't have to be around these teachers like all the time. In fact, that has its own set of problems, like I mentioned. Yeah. So those, you know, with that in mind, check out some of the communities that are referenced. Again, trust your intuition, see how they speak to you, see how they relate to you. See what happens when your heart is open. In the Vajrayana world, they say, you know, you found your teacher when you've fallen in love. I think that's really true. But the really tricky thing there is you have to worry about all the psychological projection and stuff that happens. So I'm trying to do sound bites to some really deep, complex, thorny issues. But that's what comes to mind, my friend, something like that.
Well, could you put in the chat column just some of those ones that you mentioned, so I can look them up?
I'll have Alyssa, can you do this for me, dear? Yeah, so Pundarika, P-U-N-D-A-R, Pundarika. You can just look up that. That's Sagnya Rinpoche's deal. Teregar, T-E-R-G-A-R, that's Mingyur Rinpoche.
Okay.
Nalanda Bodhi, N-A-L-A-N-D-A-B-O-D-H-I, Nalanda Bodhi. Oh, I forgot another one, Dzigar Khyentse Rinpoche. So his entity is Sri Mangala Bhuti, S-H-R-I, M-A-N-G-A-L-A, B-H-U-T-I. He's here in Colorado. Pema studies with him. Then you got, what else did I leave out? those right there, they're just rock stars, right?
Oh, I've watched some of these videos on, you know, my computer here at home. But, you know, in my experience, I always get more out of being in direct contact with people. Not that I've lived in, you know, a monastery or lived in, but like, for example, in Portland, Oregon, they had a Zen house.
Yeah.
And which was open to the public for meditations on Sunday morning. And, you know, I go there maybe once a week or maybe twice at the most.
Right.
I'm not looking for someone who I can see every day or every week. So this is.
So tell me, Jerry, where do you live in Michigan exactly?
I live just immediately north of Detroit in a suburb called St. Clair Shores.
Yeah, I know exactly. My brother used to live in St. Clair Shores. I know exactly.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he lived right on the lake. I know exactly.
Wow.
Yeah, I know that area really well. So, I mean, you could also talk to Myra, who's got her hand up here.
Oh, yeah. I've talked to Myra. I sent her several emails, but we can never seem to connect to each other. She's really, really busy.
Right, as is everybody.
But, yeah,
you know,
I know.
You're not that far from Madison. I mean, it's not that close, but it's also not that far, which is like that's the local epicenter for tarragar in the Midwest. And again, I don't know all the different locations of these centers.
Right.
I mean, you might have one in Detroit, and I don't even know about it. I'm not up on how many.
There is a Zen center, and I've gone there once and had an interview with the master, a one-on-one interview after a meditation session. And somehow, I mean, she hardly said anything. I mean, you know, she'd sometimes just nod her head, and I didn't feel any connection. So I
know. No, that's fine. Exactly. That's fine. You know, I have a similar sort of thing with the Zen thing. It's not a criticism at all, but the Zen thing doesn't really speak to me. And okay. So that's not your deal. I mean, my very first exposure was with a Zen thing, and I had like zero connection to it. I have tremendous respect for it. It's not a criticism at all, but it just didn't speak to me.
Yeah.
So that doesn't mean anything. So then you just trust your heart, and then eventually something will click. And then, you know, Myra's coming on next. Maybe she has something to say. But with these days and the sophistication of online presences, the communities that I am aware of have really, especially with COVID, they really ramped up their online presence.
Mm-hmm.
Like Tergar offers, their online community is astounding. There's so much there. And so I unconditionally refer people to entities like that.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome. Hey, Myra. Yeah, Chökyi Nyingma Rinpoche, of course. Yeah, exactly. He's another fantastic teacher, and he's got, some of these are pinging in. He's wonderful. Part of the family, by the way, with Tsogyen Rinpoche and Minju Rinpoche. He also, you know, he spends most of his time in Kathmandu at the White Monastery. But he visits, there's a retreat center of his here in Colorado, Fair Play. He's got stuff on the East Coast, I know for sure on the West Coast. So there are lots. Anyway, Myra, fire away. What's up?
Yeah, I apologize, Jerry. I still work about 50 or 60 hours a week. And just to know, in terms of Michigan, in terms of the depth that he's looking for, actually, most of my community is virtual, except the yoga studios and the other little things that we do around. So he knows that. But anyway, the other day when you were in that wonderful weekend that we had this weekend, something interesting, you were talking about the sense of self and how a lot of people, or some data talking that many people have it on their head, like behind the eyes, that sense of self that is not there.
Yeah.
And I wanted more information that, because when you said it, there was such a somatic sensation trying to find that self. I got, you know, we ask in meditation many times, where is the self and where can you find it or not find it? And when you said that, there was like, I directly went to space to try to find that self in the middle of my head. Where is that information? Why is that localization somatic sensation of a self most likely in there, according to data?
Yeah, and again, we're talking about S, small s, not big S.
Yeah, right.
Because when
yeah.
people are talking about big S, then they'll usually point to the heart.
Yeah.
I would have to dig up, I don't know the reference off the top of my head, but I definitely did not make that up. That studies have shown when people identify their provisional sense of self / ego identity, they tend to point to a space a little bit above and behind the eyes, which again, like I mentioned during the weekend, makes a lot of sense, right? Because we tend to situate ourselves, this kind of echolocation process, visually. So to me, that makes a lot of sense. And when we're visualizing, interestingly enough, to connect that to that topic, we almost always visualize. When I say for instance, visualize something at your throat for dream yoga, we don't even think about it. By default, we automatically think, oh, I'm just going to look down from here to create this visualization in my throat, right? That's just kind of what we do. But that's not what the visualization is actually inviting. That's just where we go. So even that is revelatory, right? When I say visualize something in your throat or in your heart, well, you're almost always by default going to say, okay, I'm going to go from here and I'm going to look down on it, which means that this, even that is revelatory of this provisional self-sense. But fundamentally, along those lines, the visualization is not taken from this generation, from this locus. It's actually taken fundamentally from the throat and the heart itself. But in terms of the actual studies and stuff, I'd have to dig that up, Myra. That's not at the top of my head right now. But I know for a fact, and this one reason, this is a kind of a tragic implication of this. It's one reason why when most people commit suicide by firearms, they almost always shoot themselves in the head, because that's where they think the problem is, and that's where they think they're going to kill themselves, is through the head. Hardly ever do they shoot themselves in the heart. So that's a kind of a shadow, a dark side of this sort of phenomenon as well. But again, I didn't make it up. I just can't pull the actual data on that, but it's out there. So if you want me to find it, I can do it in
pain. Well, no. It just that it almost felt also like the subtle body. And when we're moving energies sometimes in certain visualizations, it felt that strong. And I was just curious about the reaction.
I mean, think about it. When you think about, we're wake-centric beings, we're sight-centric, photocentric. And so basically that centricity is almost, again, it's just another, to me, data point that we tend to centralize our sense of identity up here, right? In the head center.
Just thank you.
Sense, especially because of vision being such a dominant sense faculty, right?
Right. So
that's what comes to mind.
Thanks. Okay.
Yeah, bye. You and Jerry still have to get up.
Yes, we try.
Okay, from Francesca. Okay. Tergar, nice to see you, dear. Tergar is truly amazing. They have a huge offering and teachers are great. 100% agree.
There's a couple of questions right above all the links I posted.
Too. Yeah, Andrew, can I ask which teacher Yonda, you, Kempo Tsultrum Gyamsa Rinpoche. Yeah, Kempo Rinpoche, Lynn. I'll never forget it. He spanked me pretty good with that yawn. It was awesome. From Linda, with regard to receiving empowerment to commitment to prescription level mantra, can you please elaborate? What do you mean by commitment? Does this mean one must be monogamous with regard to spiritual practice and not mix practices from different traditions? No, it does not mean that, Linda. What it means is that when you're doing full-blown tantric stuff and you're doing like full-blown legitimate deity yoga and the whatnot, what that means is that this level of commitment is brought about. There's a number of ways to talk about this, Linda. One is through the types of vows that are associated with each vehicle. So for instance, if you become a card-carrying Buddhist, you know, you take a certain set of vows. There are certain precepts, certain things that you do. When you enter the Mahayana path, there's a further set of vows and precepts, Bodhisattva vow that you take and the like. And then when you're doing Vajrayana practices, you get these empowerments and then you make commitments that involve what are called Samaya vows. And so I'm not sure how far I can run with this. I might recommend, Linda, that you look, probably the best accessible material on this is Reggie Ray's book, Secrets of the Vajra World. He writes a fair amount about this sort of thing. And so what it does, when you do this, you go to an empowerment, and some of them are, again, open to the public. Others you can't even go to the empowerment unless you've already completed a fair amount of requirements, preparatory work and the like, because in a certain way that weeds out the shoppers. So the people that come to these empowerments they've already done the homework, they've already kicked the tires, they've already looked under the hood, they've done the testing, and they go, yeah, this works for me, I'm willing to make this commitment. So then you go to a more restrictive, not over-the-counter public empowerment. And then you know going in advance, like a wedding, that there's going to be these commitments, what are called these Samaya vows. And they're going to require a particular number of recitations, a particular commitment in terms of either time or recitation. And again, these are all there for a very specific reason. They're not social constructs. They're not there to really do anything more than create a proper protective holding environment where when you get these particular teachings, they just have the power that they are actually designed to have. And so, you know, let me see if I'm missing here. With regard to receiving empowerments, commitment, prescription level mantra, can you please elaborate? Yeah, so the commitment basically means the Samaya vows. There are 14 of those. This is definitely not the place to talk about those. Each one of these vows, this is actually very interesting. When you take all these vows, it seems like, oh my God, I'm taking all these vows and everything's like so restrictive. Well, it's actually, I've reflected on this a lot because what all these vows do, and again, I'm not naming them all because it's not the right place to do it. Each one of these vows from Hinayana, Mahayana to Vajrayana vows each one of these sets of vows just further contains you into what? The present moment. And so it's kind of the irony of this type of containment. By fundamentally being so contained, so restricted in a certain sense, what it's doing is it's containing and restricting the discursive mind. And the commitments basically empower the present moment, because in a very real way, they restrict you to the present moment. So these are very, very skillful means that these wisdom traditions have come up with to create the proper container for these really high power practices to be introduced. Because if they're not held within these particular containers, not only do they not work, they can become dangerous. This is not the environment to talk into further about all these particularities. But fundamentally, there's a tremendous rationale reason for these sorts of things. And again, if you're interested, I'm pretty darn sure that Reggie Ray talks about this in his book, Secrets of the Vajra World. Okay? All right. Let me hear. There's one other here. Jerry, you're going to have to ping me outside of this context, because I don't even know which course you're talking about. So this is a direct message to me. Send me an email at andrew@andrewholacek.com. We can track this down for you, because I don't even know what five-part course you're talking about. Okay? All right. Cool. Well, thanks, everybody. If there's nothing else, I think we're good for today. Dream sharing group again on Saturday with Marianne. We have our usual stuff starting again next week. The meditation group, as you know. I think we actually have the Dr. Ed sleep medicine thing next week as well. And then the book study group for the following Thursday. So nice to see everybody. Take care of yourselves. Remember, to whatever extent, if dedication of merit means something to you, whatever we have gathered here of any value, we share it out for the benefit of all beings. So we realize what we're doing here is not just for ourselves. It's really for this world at large. Do never forget that. But in the meantime, take care of yourself, take care of others, and I look forward to seeing you around town, so to speak. Bye, everybody.